In the intensive care unit, the onset of acute renal failure has often to remain a lethal complication for the past 50 years. Once established, acute renal failure usually requires renal replacement therapy during the days to weeks that require for recovery of renal function. Hemodialysis continues to be perfected, and we're also developing new forms of renal replacement therapy, but they have not resulted in a significant improvement of survival of acute renal failure. Patients who have acute renal failure have more than a 50% probability of death, and those patients in the intensive care unit who develop acute renal failure, an increasing proportion of them are developing an association with sepsis and sepsis syndromes. Typically, a patient will develop sepsis and then a condition called SIRS, which is systemic inflammatory response syndrome. We've all heard the silly expression that if one jumps out of a plane, it's not the fall that kills you, but it's a sudden stop. Now our model for approaching infection is often it's not the infection that will kill a patient, but the patient's own body's response to that infection. That'll develop an inflammatory cascade called SIRS, or systemic inflammatory response syndrome, and it's that SIRS that produces multi-organ failure to the patient and, in a lot of cases, death. The idea that remote events in the body can produce a renal failure was something that was really first elucidated, which is a fancy word for teased out, in World War II. In World War II, during the bombing campaigns of the Germans in London, large numbers of people were entrapped in collapsed buildings, and this resulted in crush injuries often to their lower extremities. When these patients were rescued, these crushed and ischemic extremities released the muscle pigment myoglobin. Myoglobin, as you know, or may not know, is a nephrotoxin or kidney poison, and that produced renal failure in the days to follow. So there was really the first example where we looked at where a remote injury or remote event in the body could result in direct damage or injury to the kidneys. Then, in World War II, when a patient developed acute renal failure, the mortality rate was approximately 80%. Renal replacement therapy really came on scene in the late 40s, and there was some hope that we would see a significant decline in its mortality rate. And initially, it did certainly help with issues of managing potassium and uremia, but dialysis was really incapable of reducing the mortality rate associated with acute renal failure less than 50%. It wasn't until the Korean War where, even with aggressive resuscitation, that the association of renal failure with sepsis was really drawn. In 1967, at the shock trauma unit at the University of Maryland, some researchers, Strach, demonstrated that patients with septic shock with renal dysfunction had a decreased glomerular filtration rate, which then attributed to a decrease in renal blood flow. And it was the renal failure that was directly linked to the death in those patients in that particular study. At the same time, in Southeast Asia, during the Vietnam conflict, individuals who developed renal failure, it was concluded that infection was the direct result in 72% of the deaths. What exactly is acute renal failure? It's defined as an abrupt decrease in kidney function that results in the accumulation of nitrogenous solutes. What does that mean? Well, it means your kidneys don't work very well. You see an elevation of BUN, you see an elevation of creatinine. You also see some problems with the electrolytes. And the most notable of those is potassium. We have the urine output in acute renal failure typically is what we call oliguric. That means it's not, you know, not much urine, low urine output. And the definition for a low urine output is roughly 400 milliliters per day. There's also non-oliguric renal failure, and that means you're making urine. And sometimes the urine, not only is the rate normal, but you may also see large amounts of urine. But despite having normal urine output or high urine output, the solute clearance, the removal of the nitrogenous waste products, is decreased. And so therefore, you see an elevation of things like your BUN, your creatinine, and some electrolyte problems, so things like potassium. And this is what I refer to as dumb urine. You're making urine, but it's not helpful urine, and it's certainly not intelligent urine. We've certainly passed along to the idea that the mortality rate associated with renal failure is high, and we're looking at a number of approximately 50%. Regardless of the urine output, the complications from acute renal failure are from the retention of those metabolic waste products. You see an increase in your BUN, you see an increase in the serum concentrations, you have problems with hypervolemia, and you have problems with electrolyte imbalances. Typically, we classify acute renal failure whether it's pre-renal or happening before the kidney, post-renal happening after the kidney, and this is including mostly the collecting systems, the bladder, the urethra, and the intrinsic parenchymal disease. And this is the kidney proper. Let's start with some of the parenchymal disease. And these things typically incur things like ATN, which is acute tuberular necrosis, pigment nephropathy. This is typically from circulating myoglobin or hemoglobin. In a burn setting, patients will get myoglobin from massive muscle destruction, from electrical injuries, which basically cooks the muscles. Also, thermal injuries can cause myoglobin release. In very deep third-degree and fourth-degree burns, the muscle is destroyed, releasing myoglobin. And with circumferential burns of the lower extremities, patients can get compartment syndromes, creating release of myoglobin, which is nephrotoxic. Other causes of parenchymal disease are things like acute glomerulonephritis and vasculitis, but these typically aren't causes of acute renal failure in the ICU patient. Renal parenchymal disease is responsible for about 10 to 30% of the cases of acute renal failure. And renal parenchymal disease is really diagnosed after excluding any pre-renal or renal causes. Typically, things that you can do to suggest renal parenchymal disease: patients will typically have a normal volume status, have normal perfusion. Specific gravity of the urine is less than 1.015. The urine osmolality is less than 350. And the urine sodium is greater than 40. Basically, they're not able to concentrate the urine, and they have a FeNA that's typically greater than 3%. The causes typically are from ischemia or big lung nephrotoxic drugs, pigment nephropathy, and rarely drug-induced allergic interstitial nephritis. I want to go over those again to really make the point. Ischemia, nephrotoxic drugs, pigment, and drug-induced allergic interstitial nephritis, things like cephalosporins and so forth. But when you look at those four things, it's probably fair to say that the most common cause of renal failure in the surgical ICU patient is a multifactorial cause. Now, when we look at ATN, as far as intrinsic renal parenchymal disease, ATN is the big one. It's really responsible about 80% of the cases. And the majority of cases of ATN are from, as we said, ischemic and toxic insults. The ischemic causes typically have a higher incidence of oliguria and a more prolonged clinical course. When you're looking at a surgical ICU and whether a patient's having ischemia causing the renal failure, you know, are they a trauma patient? They have a large intraoperative blood loss. Go back, look at the anesthesia record. Were there periods of hypotension on the anesthesia operative record? Was there large blood losses associated with that as well? ACE inhibitors are another big one, because what they do is they actually cause the efferent arterial to dilate. Patients with bilateral renal artery stenosis, congestive heart failure, NSAIDs can also cause it, cirrhosis, and even prolonged azotemia from a variety of sources. Nephrotoxic agents, that's a big one. Aminoglycoside antibiotics, chemotherapy agents, radiographic contrast material. And again, if you're looking at patients in any intensive care unit, large percentage of patients are on any one, if not multiple, of these agents. What are some of the drugs that can cause renal failure? The nephrotoxin? Well, heroin. Not something we give our patients very often. Hydralazine. Penicillin G. Thiazides. Aminoglycosides. Amphotericin. Polymyxin. Lithium. Vitamin D intoxication. Acetaminophen. Aspirin. Methicillin. But contrast media is probably the big one. The actual way that each individual drug damages the kidney is dependent individually on each of the offending drugs. So it's not one method by which nephrotoxic drugs injure the kidney. But through the processes of resorption and secretion, the kidney is exposed to high concentrations of these drugs, and the byproducts of them often can be toxic. If the patient is hypovolemic, that'll make the problem even worse. Since most of the damage occurs to the tubules after the drug has been filtrated through the glomerulus, often patients who have a nephrotoxic injury to the kidney by the drugs will have non-oliguric renal failure, because the glomerulus is not injured, it's the tubules, and therefore these patients will have normal urine output. Focusing a little bit on contrast media, very common nephrotoxin. The incidence of contrast nephropathy is between 1 and 10% and can be predicted according to a number of risk factors. These include the amount of contrast that's given, the age of the patient, any pre-existing renal insufficiency, as well as diabetes. Pigment nephropathy is not an uncommon cause of acute renal failure, and as I said earlier, it's typically seen in patients who are trauma patients or burn patients, or result of some operation or other kind of catastrophe. Any kind of insult or ischemia or blunt injury to large muscle masses that can release myoglobin to the circulation. Myoglobin is a well-known nephrotoxin. Now here's where it gets a little bit interesting and complicated, is that myoglobin by itself is not a direct nephrotoxin. But if it gets in the presence of acidic urine, okay, so the myoglobin is released into urine, the urine has a low pH or is acidic, then it creates a molecule known as ferrohemate. Ferrohemate is toxic to the renal cells. So if a patient has large breakdown of myoglobin released in the urine, one thing that we can do to prevent renal failure is to prevent the conversion of myoglobin to ferrohemate. One way to prevent myoglobin-induced renal failure is to suspect it and recognize which patients are at risk. Therefore, patients who have burns, trauma, seizures, alcohol, drugs, and intoxications, prolonged ischemia to muscle groups, and extended coma, these are the patients who are at risk. Now, you can get serum CPKs. They're typically elevated. You can send urine for urine myoglobin, though that would take a significant long period of time. What we'd recommend doing is get a urinalysis. If you see large free hemoglobin and few red cells, that's highly indicative of a patient having myoglobin. Now, if a patient is spilling myoglobin in their urine, we need to prevent the ongoing damage to the kidney. We do this by aggressive hydration, trying to get a urine output of at least 100 milliliters per hour. Also, we can use osmotic diuretics and alkalinize the urine. Now, alkalinizing the urine, we need to discuss this, because what people think of alkalinizing the urine is that a pH of less than 7 is acid. Is acid, a pH greater than 7 is alkaline, and the uninitiated will try to get the pH greater than 7. It's a very difficult task if you're able to do it at all. When you're trying to alkalinize the urine to prevent that formation of ferrohemate, you want to get the pH greater than 6. That's it. It's a relative alkalinization. Get the pH greater than 6. That'll prevent the conversion of myoglobin to ferrohemate. That'll prevent the ferrohemate from acting as a nephrotoxin. Now, interstitial nephritis is not something that we actually end up taking care of often in a surgical ICU, but it accounts for about 10% of the cases of intrinsic renal failure. Drug-induced allergic interstitial nephritis accounts for about 90% of the cases of acute interstitial nephritis. And numerous other drugs can cause it. And a lot of drugs are drugs that are commonly used in ICUs, and this is why we should rule it out. Those are drugs like penicillin, cephalosporins, sulfonamides, NSAIDs, and some diuretics. The time of onset is variable from the time the patient takes the medication to the time the patient begins to develop symptoms. It could be days, it could be weeks. The patient could be started on an antibiotic on Monday. They may not demonstrate symptoms until the following Friday or Saturday. Most of the cases are considered to be what's called idiosyncratic and are not dose-related. People could have fever, they could have skin rash, and eosinophilia. Arthralgias are also common. Eosinophiluria is present in most of the cases of antibiotic-related disease. So when we do our workups of patients who are in these surgical ICUs and they're having renal failure, this is the reason why we obtain urine eosinophils. Why? Most patients are on either a penicillin or cephalosporin, and we want to rule out the presence of an interstitial nephritis. The syndrome should resolve after we get rid of the offending drug. Steroids may also help speed the recovery. And keep in mind that we said that renal causes, renal parenchymal diseases of acute renal failure only account for about 10 to 30% of the cases. Certainly the most common cause is prerenal causes. And this is anything really that causes hypotension or hypoperfusion. Patients under resuscitated, hypovolemia from hemorrhagic blood loss. Other causes could be a myocardial dysfunction, MI causing a decrease of flow. as well as abdominal compartment syndrome can impair renal blood flow. The best way to really prevent pre-renal renal failure is making sure the patient has adequate volume resuscitation. Those patients who typically are coming out of the operating room, they're a trauma patient, a burn patient, or typically patients that you see just in most surgical intensive care units have a pretty significant cause to have pre-renal renal insufficiency. And as we've said, this is the most common cause of acute renal failure. Patients may have had blood loss, they may have third spacing going along with their intra-abdominal operation. If they're a burn patient, they're going to have just massive and sensible and evaporative losses as well as interstitial edema. So there, certainly make sure that you have given the patient adequate preload, volume resuscitate them. If you give the patient 1, 2, perhaps at the outer limit 3 liters of crystalloid and you're not seeing an improvement in their urine output, then you need to start moving towards intravascular monitoring, perhaps in a CVP or a SWAN to obtain a pulmonary artery occlusive pressure. This is a highly controversial topic in the literature. There's reams and reams of articles written on, do SWANs really improve outcomes? And I'm not actually a big believer in those. I'm not a big believer in PA catheters anymore as well, but we do have things like lithium dilution cardiac output monitors and certainly echocardiography or transesophageal echo is helpful in determining preload and cardiac function. You want to obtain the usual studies that you obtain in a patient who's oliguric, working of acute renal failure. You want to get the urine eosinophils, looking for the interstitial nephritis, like we've already talked about. You want to get urinalysis, looking specifically at the specific gravity, urine osmolality, and urinary sodium. When you look at the urine osmolality is typically going to be greater than 400. The specific gravity is going to be greater than 1.024, and the urinary sodium is going to be less than 20. What these numbers indicate, that the kidney is trying to maximally concentrate the urine. It's trying to retain on much of the water it possibly can, and why it does that by holding on to the sodium, and that's why you see the low sodium. One thing that I didn't mention that certainly is worthy of consideration is the abdominal compartment syndrome. Patients who've had massive fluid resuscitations from hemorrhage, trauma, surgery, burn, whatever, we're seeing a large number of patients having abdominal compartment syndrome. Again, this is another highly controversial topic, as perhaps we're giving patients way too much fluid creating this. I like to call it iatrogenesis imperfecta or iatrogenesis magnum. But abdominal compartment syndrome is really manifested by a very tight abdomen, peak inspiratory pressures on the ventilator, because with abdominal compartment syndrome, the intra-abdominal viscera, the bowels, the liver, whatever, swell. And as they swell, they push up on the diaphragm, making it very hard for the diaphragm to travel downward on inspiration. So if the patient's on a mechanical ventilator, they're going to have very high peak inspiratory pressures if they're on a volume mode, or very low tidal volumes if they're on a pressure mode. How this affects the kidney is that all that pressure on the in the abdomen pushes down on the vena cava and pushes down on the renal vein. Now, if the patient has a mean arterial pressure of 65, that's the mean pressure in the renal artery going into the kidney. If a normal patient has a CVP of 5, then 65 minus 5 gives a mean perfusion pressure of roughly 60. But if their intra-abdominal pressure from their abdominal compartment syndrome is 30, that pressure is then transmitted onto the renal vein, making that pressure in the renal vein approximately 30. Well, then you've got your 65 for your mean pressure minus your 30 for your CVP or renal vein pressure. That gives you only a perfusion pressure of roughly 35. That decreases the blood flow through the kidney and therefore certainly decreases the function of the kidney. And in those cases, a decompressive laparotomy should improve renal function. So if you think somebody may have abdominal compartment syndrome, certainly you're going to look at their abdomen, but you're also going to measure bladder pressures. Certainly last, but definitely not least, if you think somebody is pre-renal, you've done the appropriate studies, you need to be thinking about intravascular monitoring, as we've mentioned. Now, there are some conditions that will make the tests, such as the FeNA and the urinary sodium, inaccurate. And one is giving the patient diuretic. Diuretics work by inducing what we call a natriuresis. Natriuresis means the peeing out of sodium. So if you give a drug that basically works by making you pee out the sodium and with it the water, then your urinary sodium is going to be falsely elevated. There are other conditions. If the acute renal failure is after the use of a contrast dye, or patients who have CHF or cirrhosis, that'll also make these studies inadequate or inaccurate. Postrenal causes of acute renal failure occur in about 1 to 15% of the cases of acute renal failure. As the name implies, postrenal, these are things that are going to be causing problems that are distal to the kidney, essentially the ureter, the bladder, and the urethra. And by the nature of these are typically what we call an obstructive uropathy. Obstructive meaning something's obstructing it, and uropathy, obviously, something affecting the urogenital system. Things that can cause this, probably the most common, is something like a plug Foley catheter. And this is one of the first things you should do when a patient has low urine output, is ask somebody to irrigate the catheter, make sure that the catheter is patent. This is clearly important in somebody who has blood or pigment in their urine or any kind of sediment in their urine. Patients may have some flank pain because of distension of the renal capsule, or they could have suprapubic pain caused by the bladder distension. So obviously you want to feel the abdomen. If you feel a palpable bladder, that's a problem. Some hospitals have these little ultrasound machines that the nurses can go around and assess whether the patient has urinary distension, need to have a visible bladder. With more and more use of ultrasound in the intensive care unit, that would be another good indication for an ultrasound. It's just do a very quick ultrasound of the abdomen and to see if the bladder is distended. If a patient's not making urine and they have a distended bladder, you would have a pretty good suspicion that the Foley catheter isn't draining properly. So what do we do when our patient is experiencing acute renal failure? Well, let's first of all look at the non-oliguric acute renal failure. This would be the patient who's still making urine, but we see an elevation in their BUN and creatinine. First thing is to consider non-renal causes of the azotemia, or that elevation of BUN and creatinine. Well, what are some of these things? Well, the BUN is a nitrogenous waste product of protein catabolism or protein metabolism. And if you have conditions that's causing an increase in the breakdown of protein, which is also known as catabolism, that will result in an increase in the BUN. Corticosteroids, which are pretty common use anymore, for right or for wrong reasons, can cause an increase in your BUN. So if you're looking at the medication list, patient has a BUN, they're making good urine, corticosteroids may be a cause of that. GI bleeding is a common cause as well, and that's another thing that you always want to be thinking about. If your patient, say, has a hemoglobin of 10 one day and it drops to 7 the next, and you see an elevation of the BUN, that should make one start thinking about a possible GI bleed. Hyperalimentation, increase creatinine can be seen with rhabdomyolysis, and administration of certain drugs as well can cause an increase in creatinine. The workup of a patient who has non-oliguric acute renal failure is very similar to that of the patient who has oliguric renal failure. If a patient has a creatinine of 4, again, you do the same studies. You get urine for eosinophils, urinary sodium, urinalysis, ultrasound of the abdomen. But obviously, you wouldn't be giving these patients fluid challenges. Look at the medication list again. Look for any potential nephrotoxic drugs for the first thing. And the second thing you want to do is make sure that if you have any medications that need renal adjustment, typically some antibiotics, if you have a patient on Lovenox for DVT prophylaxis, you want to discontinue the Lovenox and switch it over to heparin. Now let's approach our patient who is not making urine and has an elevation of creatinine. This is the one we typically see the most commonly, and this is what we would call oliguric, or not making much urine, acute renal failure. You know, as I said earlier, the first thing you do is you do the simple stuff first, and you make sure that your Foley catheter is working well. Make sure that you're able to irrigate the catheter and exclude those postrenal causes. If you know that your Foley catheter is irrigating well, get the ultrasound of the abdomen, rule out any upper tract obstruction. They'll be able to tell if there's any dilation of the renal pelvis. Now, if the patient has two kidneys, it would seem unlikely that if they had an obstruction of one ureter that they would experience acute renal failure. But it's important to keep in mind that 1% of the population has a solitary kidney, and a functionally solitary kidneys, and that's where one is non-functional, are even more common. So let me go over that again. 1% of the patient, 1% of the population has one kidney. And there is a group of patients out there who have two kidneys anatomically present, but only one of them is functional, and that occurs at a frequency of greater than 1%. Once you've ruled out the postrenal causes, then you really need to focus on the prerenal causes. You want to give the patient a fluid challenge, and that's typically 10% of the estimated circulating volume, about 500 to a liter in an adult, 500 mLs to a liter. I personally don't like the 500 ml fluid bowls. There was an article that came out in Critical Care Medicine in the late 90s. It really showed that a 500 cc fluid challenge was hardly a fluid challenge at all. And if the patient is having pre-renal oliguria, once you give them the fluid challenge, you'll see an improvement in the urine output. Typically, we do this with lactated ringers or saline solution. So keep in mind, and we'll talk about this in a subsequent talk, but if you give somebody a liter of fluid and you see the urine output improve for the next hour, and then the hour after that the urine output starts dropping again, there's a very good explanation for that. And that is that 65 to 75% of the fluid you administer as that fluid bolus leaves the vascular compartment within 30 minutes of giving it. Therefore, the improvement in the urine output you're likely to see is only going to be transient. Now this gets to one of my pet peeves, and that is, if you have somebody going to, I don't know, make it a post-operative patient from a colectomy, or a minor trauma, or a major trauma, or a burn, and you've got their fluid rate going at 100, or 150, or 200, and that urine output is dropping off over a couple of hours, and you think that they have pre-renal oliguria, then you give them a fluid bolus, and the urine output improves for an hour or two, and then it goes back down again, and people bolus them again. If you're having to repeat bolus the patient, maybe you need to really consider your maintenance rate. And this is what we call our bump and bolus. We'd like a patient to make 30 cc's of urine an hour. If they're making more than 100, they're probably making too much. But if we've got them going at 100 and we have to give them a bolus and they drop off again, and we have to give them another bolus, why would we keep them going at 100 cc's an hour? Maybe we take that fluid rate up to 125, 150, 200. I don't know what the right rate would be. I don't know what your patient is. I don't know what their problem is. But clearly, the first fluid rate is not appropriate. So reevaluate that. The other thing you need to think about is maybe the patient's volume status is appropriate, but maybe they have a flow problem. Now keep in mind, what's the difference between volume and flow? Well, volume is how much volume is it, or how much fluid is in the container, how much fluid is in the vascular system. Flow is how well it's moving forward. You may have a patient who has adequate volume on board, but the heart isn't pumping it forward fast enough. And that would make you think, does the patient have poor cardiac output? Have they suffered a myocardial event? And again, if they had a myocardial event from myocardial ischemia or cardiomyopathy or valvular heart disease, you need to really tailor your therapy to the patient's principal problems. I'm not really that old, at least I don't think I am, but when I was a resident and a fellow, echocardiography wasn't as readily available as it is now. And it makes things simply much more easier in the intensive care units managing patients with cardiac diseases, because you need to consider patients who have valvular heart disease. You need to adjust your treatments based on that. Patients who have left ventricular hypertrophy, we certainly are able to gain much more information about the patient's anatomical lesions of the heart, which certainly allows us to customize their physiological management as well. Now, what do we do in the patient? We talked about the pre-renal, we talked about the post-renal, but what if the patient has an intrinsic or a parenchymal injury to the kidney? Well, as we've already talked about, when we introduce parenchymal diseases, typically the insult's already happened. So what we need to do is just simply make sure that we don't continue to injure the kidney, be it with nephrotoxins or whatever. So make sure that you remove the offending agent, and typically our treatment is mostly supportive at that point as far as the parenchymal injury to the kidney. Diuretics have been debated over the years. People used to try to convert oliguric or low urine output renal failure to non-oliguric or urine output renal failure with the premise that those patients were just easier to manage and had improved survival. Well, I would agree that the patients typically seem, at least when you're taking care of them, to be easier to manage, but the data has not demonstrated an improvement in outcomes. But I'm always looking for new data on that topic because my bias certainly is that they're easier to maintain when they're still peeing. But we want to talk about evidence-based medicine, not, as one of my fellows would say, eminence-based medicine. Renal range dopamine. Now, renal range dopamine is, to me, one of the more entertaining things that goes on and associated with acute renal failure. I can't tell you how many times over the years, hundreds if not thousands of times, I put people on, quote, renal range dopamine for the purposes of improving renal blood flow. Absolutely no data to support that. Our thinking when we did that was that dopamine basically acted at dopaminergic receptors on the kidney and improved renal blood flow. Absolutely no data to support that. No data at all. Now, when you put people on dopamine, you actually increase their cardiac output. So there may be some improvement in their cardiac output. Dopamine is a natriuretic, and what I said earlier, a natriuretic means you pee off sodium, so it's another word for saying it's a diuretic. So you're giving a drug that improves cardiac output, and improvement in cardiac output does what to renal blood flow? Well, it improves it. That will do what to urine output production? That'll improve it. If you give a diuretic, what will it do to urine output? It'll improve it. But the idea that dopamine is acting through dopaminergic receptors to improve renal blood flow and preserve renal function, no data. Dopamine does not prevent the development or limit the prognosis of acute renal failure. Now, everything we do has an action and reaction. And, you know, starting somebody on an inotrope is not a benign thing. You're certainly going to have the potential of increasing the myocardial oxygen consumption. Inducing cardiac arrhythmias even at the low doses of less than 5 or 2.5 mics per kilogram per minute of dopamine, which is what we used to consider the, quote, renal range dopamine. Now, if a patient is in acute renal failure, you really want to keep a close eye on the electrolytes. Keep in mind what I said earlier is that people who have renal failure don't die of renal failure. They die of complications of renal failure. And those complications are volume overload, electrolyte abnormalities, and GI bleeds and coagulopathies. So you want to get your electrolytes at least daily, and if there's a lot of change, you want to get them probably even more frequently. The one that we typically are attuned to is hyperkalemia. And hyperkalemia, we typically think of high potassium of greater than 5, but certainly greater than 6.5 is a medical emergency. Now, in a situation where you have a lot of catabolism, a lot of tissue injury, you're going to have large amounts of potassium released. And you can see pretty rapid increases of your potassium over a reasonably short period of time. Now, hyperkalemia can cause some real significant cardiac problems and can ultimately result in asystole. The classic EKG findings that we talk about are loss of P waves, widening of the QRS, and then ever so popular peak T waves. So it's the peak T waves that we commonly think of when we talk about hyperkalemia. There's really two approaches that we use when we talk about treatment of hyperkalemia in a patient who's got acute renal failure. Well, probably actually three approaches, I should say. Probably the most definitive way of managing the hyperkalemia is having the patient undergo hemodialysis. Now, that would be great, but that may not be feasible because the patient may not have catheters in place. The family hasn't been consented. It may be 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night, and you don't have a dialysis a nurse immediately available, but you've got a patient who has a potassium of 6.8, and they're having peak T waves. And the question is, what do you do with that? Well, the first thing you want to do is to protect the heart from the cardiac arrhythmias. So you want to give calcium gluconate, and you want to give 10 cc's of a 10% solution. And what that does is that stabilizes the myocardial membrane from the effects of potassium and hopefully prevents any arrhythmias on the heart, certainly that dreaded asystole. Then you have the question of what are you going to do with the potassium? Now, you could hide the potassium so the body doesn't see it, or you can get rid of the potassium. And what we talk about is when we talk about hiding the potassium, let's talk about getting rid of the potassium first. You can get rid of the potassium by dialysis, dialyze it out, or you can get rid of the potassium by using potassium-trapping resins. And this is typically K-Xylate. You can give K-Xylate anywhere from 20 to 60 grams in about 100 to 150 grams of sorbitol. You could do that orally, which is really just kind of horrible, or you give it rectally, which doesn't really make the nurses incredibly happy either. As far as what's best for the patient, what's perhaps most functional or most efficient at capturing the potassium, that would be the K-Xylate given rectally. That'll actually bind the potassium and then remove it from the body. Now, what you could do, the other thing you could do is what I call hiding the insulin. And what you do when you hide the insulin is you give the insulin and the glucose. Most of the books say you can give about 10 to 15 units of regular insulin. I usually give just about 10 units of insulin and then an AMP of D50. And what that does is that drives the potassium into the cells. Now, when you think about the most of your potassium in your body lives inside the cells. Remember, you have to maintain electroneutrality across your cellular membranes. So, you know, the concentration of sodium is high outside, it's low inside the cell. And potassium pretty much mirrors it. Remember, they're both cations. So potassium's high in the cell, low outside the cell. So when you have a high potassium, by giving insulin and by giving dextrose through a co-transport mechanism, going back to some basic biochemistry flashback nightmares, you're going to push that insulin or that push that potassium into the cell, and that it will immediately lower your serum potassium levels. So that's good, right? Well, it is good if somebody's potassium 6.5 and they're having all kinds of cardiac arrhythmias. But keep in mind, you haven't decreased your total body potassium. It's still elevated. You've only lowered the serum potassium by hiding it. So over a couple of hours, that potassium will slowly start to leak out. So if somebody has a elevated potassium and you start giving them dialysis or K-exalate after you've pushed it into the cells, several hours later, you'll see the potassium start to sneak back up there. So you need to be mindful of that. Other electrolyte abnormalities you can see with people who have renal failure: low sodium, that's hyponatremia, hyperphosphatemia, we see that all the time, hypocalcemia, and metabolic acidosis. And the reason why you see the metabolic acidosis is because the kidney is not really able to make bicarbonate. I want to end looking at two conditions that I end up treating a lot as a burn ICU, as a burn surgeon and burn intensivist. Obviously, those are patients with burns and patients who have sepsis or septic shock. The burn patient is at significant risk of developing acute renal failure because of all the massive amounts of evaporative fluid losses, the fluid shifts that we see. Patients can evaporate liters upon liters of free water off of their burns in a daily period, in addition to their insensible losses they have just by being on a mechanical ventilator. Other things that can cause renal failure to burn patient is myoglobin. Electrical injuries basically will cook the muscle, and as it cooks the muscle, it releases high levels of potassium and myoglobin. People who have circumferential burns, typically to the legs, can get both compartment syndromes, which can cause muscle damage, which will release myoglobin, or they can just have burns so deep that you see direct damage to the muscles. You know, for lack of a better descriptor, you see the muscle cook, and as the muscle cooks, it releases that pigment. So again, we're always looking at the urine. You know, there's, like we talked about hyperkalemia. One of the drugs typically used to do rapid sequence or pharmacologically assisted intubations is succinylcholine. Succinylcholine is a drug that's contraindicated in cases of hyperkalemia, people who are quadriplegic or paraplegic, and in burns. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, from a pharmacological safety standpoint, you can typically give succinylcholine in the first 24 or sometimes 48 hours from a burn injury. Why you don't do that is kind of off the topic, and we could talk about that some other time. Most experienced burn providers, though, including myself, stay away from the use of succinylcholine, either in an acute burn or a patient who's been burned several days ago. But one of the things I'll do, if a patient's coming in and they're severely burned, deep burns of their legs, I'll ask for a Foley catheter before we intubate them. And that always kind of confuses people. Jeff, you know, airway breathing, CAT scan, you know, F Foley is down on the list. But I actually want to know what the urine looks like. Patient's sitting there, they're breathing, they're controlling their own airway. It takes maybe another minute to get a Foley catheter. And if you send a specimen to the lab, it's not going to come back in, you know, 4 or 5 minutes. But if I put a Foley, it's, you know, maybe 20 minutes to an hour until I get that lab back. But if I put a Foley catheter in and I see, frankly, pigmented urine, be the patient from an electrical injury or from a thermal burn with extensive injuries to their limbs, well, they've got pigment in their urine because they've got myoglobinuria. That means they've got muscle damage to the point that they release myoglobin. If their muscle damage is severe enough that it is pigment in the urine, then it also releases potassium. And in the appearance of that urine, I would certainly refrain from using succinylcholine or Enectine for a pharmacologically assisted intubation. Sepsis can cause acute renal failure through both direct and indirect methods, both through the use of endotoxins and prostaglandin-mediated damage to the renal microvascular system. Sepsis causes hypotension that can also result in kind of a pre-renal situation. The real treatment of this is treatment of the sepsis and avoidance of nephrotoxic drugs when you can help it. With more and more resistant organisms, that's becoming more and more difficult. But let's say more judicious use of your antibiotics. Certainly being mindful that a patient who is on norepinephrine in septic shock with a low mean arterial blood pressure and getting some powerful nephrotoxic antibiotics, you'd be mindful that you want to follow the renal failure closely and also follow your drug levels closely. That's a rather long podcast, but it's a huge topic, and keep in mind that there's a lot that we haven't covered in regards to acute renal failure. We haven't talked about chronic renal failure, the preoperative management of a chronic renal failure patient, and the postoperative management, and we have not even gone into the issues of renal replacement therapy. I will tell you, and I believe that this is clearly supported in the literature, is that earlier renal consultation has been demonstrated to improve outcomes in patients with acute renal failure. Now, we've quoted this statistic multiple times in this podcast. 50% of people who have acute renal failure go on to die. 1 out of 2. And we know that it's been supported in literature. Early consultation with a nephrologist improves the outcomes of these patients. I am not a nephrologist. I don't get any kickbacks from nephrologists. I'm an intensivist. I have heard intensivists say, I don't need a nephrologist to manage this until I need the patient on dialysis because I'm an ICU doctor. I can handle all things related to critical illness. I find that a little bit disconcerting. I cannot believe that after doing a fellowship in critical care that I know more about kidney disease than a nephrologist who spent 3 years in fellowship, does nothing all day but see people who have kidney disease, and does all their research and all their academic work on kidney disease. And I certainly believe in a sense of collaboration that even if I'm doing everything absolutely perfectly and there's a 1 out of 2 chance my patient can die, I want to make sure that I have all the right smart people taking care of the patient. And I think it's not a sign of weakness, but clearly a sign of maturity, collaboration, and wisdom to provide appropriate consultations at the appropriate times. So that's my brief review on acute renal failure. I hope you found it useful. My name is Jeff Guy. My podcast is called Surgery ICU Rounds. Thank you. Okay.